Hey folks, it's me, Ben Blacker, the creator and host of the Writers Panel. Thanks for giving this really great episode a listen. We have been having an absolute blast with my new monthly-ish live show, Retrospects, in which we do live staged readings of spec scripts of existing shows that professional writers wrote when they were first starting out. The first two shows, we did A Mad About You by me and A Girls by Bridget Munoz-Leibowitz. The second show, somehow even better, maybe because it didn't have a script from me. We did a gender-swapped Big Bang Theory by Helen Shang and a West Wing by Mark Guggenheim. The casts were absolutely bananas, so talented, so much fun. The next show is May 19th, and it's a special one. We're doing this as a benefit for the Green Envelope Grocery Aid Fund, which gives small grants to entertainment industry workers to help with groceries and, you know, other kind of basic needs. It's a really terrific organization. And we're doing two absolutely bonkers scripts. We're doing a Seinfeld by David Iserson, a friend of the podcast, a friend of mine. A terrific writer who wrote on New Girl. He wrote the really great movie, The Spy Who Dumped Me. So David wrote this Seinfeld spec when he was 17 years old, clearly during the height of Seinfeld. And the voices are right on. It's so good. It's genuinely funny. It also, as David emailed me when he sent me the script, takes place during the Revolutionary War for no reason whatsoever. So that is absolutely worth seeing. We're also that day doing a Succession spec by the parody account known as Fake Carol Lombardini. Check out Fake Carol on Twitter. They were sort of a big meme account during the strike. So the Succession spec, which is really, really good and really funny, takes place during the WGA and SAG strikes. It features real Carol Lombardini, as well as, you know, David Zaslav and like the CEOs of all the studios, as well as the Succession characters, which again, like, the writer just nailed the voices. This should be a really fun retrospects show, and it's for a good cause. And you can attend live or stream it for up to a week after the show. The show, again, is May 19th at the Elysian Theater in Los Angeles. You can go to elysiantheater.com. You can also go to my newsletter. I'll put links to it in all like the recent updates of the newsletter. Go to benblacker.substack.com and click the link. You can see some casting stuff there, too. I will update there first. Once again, benblacker.substack.com. Check that out. And please come out to the show. It's going to be a lot of fun. They all have been. Hope to see some of you folks there. All right. Here's today's really great episode.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writers Panel with Ben Blacker. And it's starting now. Oh, yeah.
Aaron's here. Aaron, tell the folks where they have seen your name on their television screens before, because it's a long list.
Originally, you have probably seen my name on Heroes, which is now almost 20 years old. After that, The River, Star Trek Discovery, and the Netflix series Lock and Key and Daybreak, and soon to be coming out, Spider-Man Chronicles.
Yeah, congrats. And Atlas, we should mention too, which is coming,
right? And Atlas is also coming out. Yeah, that's really exciting.
So you've got TV, you've got features. We were talking before we started recording. You've done comic books in the past. Like, you are a master of all media.
I'm a work in progress on all media. Not being self-deprecating, it is simply I'm always trying to be better and trying to hone my craft and make myself a better writer.
That's great to hear. And it's actually sort of what I wanted to start out talking about is, you know, I found, having written in various media too, that like the more you do these things, the more you tell stories in different ways, the more you learn about how to tell stories. So this is a big question to start out with, but like, maybe we can look at Spiderwick, we can look at Alice, some of the more recent stuff, and talk about, like, what have you done in those stories that maybe you couldn't have done early in your career? You didn't have the tools for it.
It's a really good question. And I think that, you know, specifically with those two, you know, the series and the feature coming out, what's really interesting about both of them is the movie Atlas I've been working on for 5 years. Spiderwick, 4 years. And within that time frame, I can see my own work really transforming kind of almost in front of my eyes. It's taking the lessons that I've learned over the 20 years of my career and applying it and making it, you know, actualized. And I think that what, you know, one of the main, and they're very, very, very different, you know, iterations. I mean, Atlas is a big, huge epic sci-fi opera, and Spiderwick is a family, you know, fantasy coming of age story. They couldn't be more different. But I think that the one, you know, one thing that I was feeling on Spiderwick was, and especially, you know, when I was coming up as a writer, one of the big people that I was actually really heavily influenced by was Brian Michael Bendis. I loved his dialogue. I loved his comics. He was obviously, you know, iterating on Quentin Tarantino a lot, but it was a big, like, write lots of dialogue, write lots of speeches. And I have, you know, kind of since, really specifically with Spiderwick, in fact, tried to move away from dialogue, tried to move away from, like, how could I tell this in the most efficient way possible with the least amount of dialogue as I can possibly use? How can I be a better visual storyteller? And that was something I really wanted to enact in Spiderwick specifically, because two reasons. One, I think it makes horror pop a lot more when the people are talking less. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, the kids, the teenagers who are the main characters of the story, are not the most eloquent people in general. Like, I love my kids. I think teenagers are amazing. And I like, especially this generation, but they're not the most verbal generation. And it's hard. It's hard to be eloquent, you know? And, you know, I don't ever want to put words in their mouths that never feel like dishonest. And so to do that, it felt like, oh, I need to really pare back on what they're saying and how they're saying it. And that was a really, yeah, it was a really, it was a lesson to learn in terms of, you know, especially, I mean, and we can get deeper into this, but this is not a slight on executives, but when a lot of people read things, they only read the dialogue. They will skip right past the action description. And I'm somebody who spends a lot of time on action description. In fact, it was one of the first things that I wrote. One of the earliest things that I did was writing a comic book for Top Cow. And one of the comments that I got back from the editor was, your action description is so cool and so amazing, and you have to stop it. You have to stop it because it's a waste of your time because it doesn't matter. And my response back to him was like, I think it does matter. I think it matters because a script in any form is a letter to, you know, it's a letter to everybody. In a television manner, this is a letter to the entire crew, to get the entire crew on board with the episode. And they are reading every word because everything that happens is important and tells them exactly tonally what a scene should be, how a prop should feel like, what the set dressing should be. It informs everything. And so I spend a lot of time in my action description. And there are often, you know, there's often moments when people are like, you know, we need to reiterate this point. And I'm like, well, it's in the action description. You just didn't read it because you were just checking the dialogue, but it's there. And I'll make sure that we do that.
But that's actually something I wanted to ask about, because this for sure is something that I, you know, grapple with. And I think so many of us do, which is like, your first audience is that layer of execs who are reading the stuff and giving you notes on it. And like, that's before the production staff, like that's before those folks read it, who read it for practical, right? So how are you working with these collaborator executives to, because that's the note you get all the time, right? Like, make sure you hit this. Like, yes, it may not be in dialogue, but it is in action. It's in a look, it's in a movement.
Yes, this is a visual medium. And you know, the way that I like to think about it is, especially early on, and it might seem, I don't know, cynical, but when you're writing that first draft of a script, it's for an audience really of one. It is for one person. It's for one decision maker to say kind of yes or no. And it feels a little like weird and wonky to think like, oh, I'm writing this whole script for one human being to judge. But that's kind of the case. And so it needs to speak to them. It needs to, and then, you know, and then you can write it more for everybody else. But that at least those first drafts and that first script is written for a very, very tiny audience. So it is about making that. And even though I will still indulge in my action description, it's really still about making sure that they're reading that action description and making sure, you know, and whether that's, and you know, I've heard all the different versions of it. And so much of it is like making sure there's enough white space on the page, you know, you hear all the time. But I certainly believe it's like, it's about ease of reading. You know, my goal as a writer is not only to make something entertaining, but it's also making the read entertaining. It's making sure that in our world where we have so many distractions, that when, you know, the exec, the decision maker picks up that script, that they will not only pick it up, they'll finish it in one reading, that they will not get distracted and put it down. That is what you're combating against. And, you know, to that end, I have a lot of little like Aaronisms that have been developed over the years, some of which have been influenced by, you know, my mentors like Brian Fuller or Michael Green. But like, I will always end a scene at the bottom of a page. I will never let it go over just a little bit onto the next page. I'll never let that happen. I will do whatever I can to make sure. And it's like, it's an annoying thing. It annoys me. And I'm sure it's annoying for people on my staff, because, you know, when I get it, like I tell them like, look, either I'm going to do it or you're going to do it, but make sure it ends on the bottom of a page, because it's just about flow. It's just it's more appealing to the eye to have it end on the bottom and then start a new scene on the next page. Even if you're not printing up, you know, the paper, even if you're reading it digitally, it's an inexplicable thing, but it is like, and it's like, it's silly because it, on some level, it has nothing to do with writing. It has nothing to do with the craft, with the story, with the themes and emotions, but it helps make the read go so much easier. And that is that's a underlying thing that we are all attempting to do, is make the read pleasurable for the audience, and for that audience of two or three or one, as the case may be.
Are there other Aaronisms? Are there other things that you have, you know, developed over the years to this end?
Yes. Unfortunately, yes. A couple things that come to mind, or at least the first thing that comes to mind, is no non-lines. No non-lines for me means, you know, every inch of dialogue needs to serve it has to serve a purpose. Like, what are you doing? That's for me, like, that's a non-line. That's like, you know, if it needs to be there, like, make it impactful, make it talk to the character. You know, it's making sure that you're being really specific with your dialogue, and that you don't just waste time and waste the reader's time with with an online, and it gets defined in very various ways. The other art is definitely about like widows and orphans is definitely just a big thing. And then, you know, I'm trying to think of if there's anything else. Those are the two biggest ones that come to mind. I'm sure writers on my staff would be like, oh, there's so many more. But those are the two that when I start a room, I'm like, look, I know this sounds really weird, but this is important to me. And you know, you don't have to do it in your own scripts. You don't have to do it. Like, I'm not preaching like this is a must do. It's just a do for this show.
Look, that makes sense for ease of reading. We've talked about that. But the specificity of language, I think, is important, right? Because that there's so much behind not just having a character say, what are you doing? Right? There's character building behind specificity of language. You know, there's giving your world a tone and a feel that is different from some other show. I think that's important.
It is. And the more you do it, because we all put those lines in, right? When we're writing dialogue, we all like that's a first pass. You will always put that in because you need it. You know, sometimes it's necessary to keep the conversation going, right? It's necessary. But then that's when I go back and I will look at those lines in my own script always and go, how do I make this better? How do I make this? And that is what starts to really define the character's voice. That's where you find it, is in those moments, because you're forced to really confront it. I remember what the other one was. So I had an amazing mentor named Kathy McCormick, who I worked on Crossing Jordan with, one of my very first jobs. And she said, essentially, if you can say a line in 8 words, see if you can say it in 4. And if you can say a line in 4 words, see if you can say it in 2. And if you can say a line in 2 words, see if you can say it in 1. And I've kept that on a post-it in my office. And that's been now over 20 years that I've had this post-it of, and essentially it says 8, 4, 2, 1. It's all it says, because all it is, and it's really helpful, especially in terms of like when you need to get your script down, when you've written that 60-page draft and you're like, oh man, if it doesn't have a 4 in front of it, you know, the studio networker is going to be, they're not even going to read it. And you have to get those 12 pages out. It's useful in that way, but it's also useful in being really explicit with your dialogue and explicit with, you know, how people talk, and making sure that you're not wasting energy and that you are, you know, making it the most concise version possible. Look, I love writing a nice monologue. I love looking at a page and it's just a mohawk of text down the middle with no action description, and just give that to an actor to like chew on and enjoy. Like, there's nothing better. But it's such a great exercise of self-editing, of can you get the same thought down to its bare essence and still convey the same point? And sometimes you can't, but a lot of the times you really can.
I want to ask another thing about Spiderwick specifically, because one of the other difficult tasks in writing a pilot, besides getting it to length and getting it compelling for that small audience of readers, pilots are so hard. There's so much they have to do. And so I wonder if you could talk, you know, you've written some pilots before, some that have gone, some that have not, but with Spiderwick, tell me about like wrangling that pilot story into shape and all the things that it had to do, the amount of story you had to tell.
Pilots are hellish. They really are. And they're so hard because you have to introduce worlds. You have to introduce characters. You have to introduce every element of story, plot. It has to have momentum. You know, it is a ridiculous balancing act to be able to accomplish. I'm really fortunate, you know, to have in Spiderwick, whether it's Spiderwick or Lock and Key, you know, those have, you know, they're adaptations. I have source material. So there is some safety net being on the high wire of literature like that, because, you know, especially even for fans, you know, I need to hit these moments. These moments need to exist within it. So that helps, that certainly helps guide things. But if you, you know, working without that safety net, it is, you know, I think I always begin a pilot with two things that I have to have. And it's really, it's even before that, it's the pit, it's even down to the pitch, whether I'm starting with a pitch or starting with a pilot, I need two things before I start writing. I need the teaser and I need the conclusion. I need the cliffhanger. Because once you have those two flags really firmly planted, you can kind of fill in the rest, right? You know where you're driving. And I mean, your podcast is so fantastic and it's been going on for so long. I'm sure somebody has said this metaphor that Robert Towns said, which is like, you know, you're driving to the airport and you know that's your destination, but you only need to see as far as your headlights go. And that's, you know, ridiculously true. And it's, I need to go to this point. I need to get to this cliffhanger. What's the best way to get there? What's the most efficient way to get there? What's the way that, and it doesn't have to also be efficient. Like what's the, even if it's a meandering way of getting there, what's the most entertaining way to get from this teaser to the end? And why those two things are the most important. And those two things have always been the most important, because you need people to watch the episode and you need people to watch the second episode. Right? That's the most important thing. It's becoming more and more important in our streaming age, because if that teaser isn't tops, you can turn out in a second. You know, I think people I can't remember, and I don't think I'm spoiling anything. Netflix at one point, when I was doing Daybreak and Lock and Key, said, look, you have to, like, it's the first 3 minutes are the most important. And I think that has gone down to now the first 30 seconds are the most important. And it's like, we are goldfish and we have to get a whole audience's attention for a whole series based on 30 seconds. It's tough. It's really hard to do. It almost feels impossible, but we try our hardest. But I know a script is going to be good, or a series is going to be good, if I can have a teaser that I know A, pitches well and will be, you know, will also shoot well and read well. And once I have that and have the cliffhanger, it feels like it's okay. Now I feel like I can be off to the races. And for Spiderwick in particular, it truly was, the first thing that I thought of was this teaser, which takes place with Christian Slater's playing Mulgrath on this bridge. And it's a fun teaser. It is horrific. And it's the lessons that I've learned, you know, it goes back to your initial question, right? It's like, the only reason why I can write a teaser like this, I feel like, is because of 20 years of writing teasers, 20 years of going through the process of, you know, whether it's writers or shows or executives. I mean, I learned so much by doing so many pilots at Warner Brothers, whether it's Peter Roth or Susan Rovner or Clancy Collins White. You know, they don't let you off the hook. And, you know, nothing was better than pitching Peter Roth, because you knew if you pitched that teaser right, you knew he was in. You could see it in his face. And certainly that's one of the reasons why, like, I'm always about, okay, what's the teaser? What is this? How do we launch this? Is it going to be enthralling? Is it going to hook the audience?
So at what point and how do you start to think about structure?
You know, structure is an interesting term now, because back in the day, and now it's coming back, you know, structure for me was really based on acts and commercial breaks. And I kind of still always went to that space of, look, every 10 pages, I need a cliffhanger. I need to have momentum and moving forward. When you don't have that, when you've taken that out of the equation, it becomes a little bit looser, certainly in terms of, you know, there's no act break. So why do you need that? Why do you need those hallmarks? But it's still like when I'm breaking story, my board is broken into teaser plus four, because it's a tried and true way to not only break a story, but also feel like, okay, do I have, and you can see it really clearly on my boards. You can see it really clearly because whether it's a, and it's, I do both note cards and whiteboards. But you know, different colors represent different characters. And what I want to see just on a purely visual level, when I'm looking at a board, that I see balance, right? That I'm looking at a board and I'm like, all the characters have the right amount of scenes in the right places, that I'm not too heavy early on and lose track of somebody later. And it, you can really just even see it when you're looking at the, when even before writing, just when you're breaking story, I can look at this board and go like, okay, yes, those are good momentum builders. Those are good, you know, kind of good act outs, but I'm also balancing the story in a good way, so that, you know, no one's disappearing and no one's losing interest.
That's smart. It's that visual step, I think, is such a necessary one. It's when we get from writers' rooms, right? It's when we get from working on boards that we often don't get when we're writing on our own. And, you know, I always encourage folks to like put it down, even just on a piece of paper, like draw the stuff out, look at it a different way.
Completely, completely. And it's, you know, I think a lot of writers experience this, you know, in our post-pandemic world. You know, I think there's a lot of programs that are good, but in doing it in a Zoom room is very different than being in person. And it's something, you know, it's something that I missed when we were in Zoom. And Spiderwick was, you know, partially Zoom and partially in person, because I was longing to get back to that being in person space where we could all look at this together. Because when you're looking at it visually on a computer, it's just not the same. You don't get the same breadth of scope. And I would recommend for anybody, like, if you can't buy a whiteboard, just buy note cards and tape and put it on a wall or put it on the floor. Like it's, you know, use that space to recreate what we do in the writer's room. Cause it's really, really valuable.
So while we're on the topic of structure, let's talk about features as well. You've written a few features. Is Atlas the first one to get made?
Atlas is the first one to be made. And thank you so much. Like seeing that poster with my name on it was like, I was a kid again. It's you know, you've worked so hard for so long and so hard. And it's like, oh my God, this movie is coming out. And I wrote a movie that feels so tremendous.
That's so exciting. I want to talk about like attacking feature structure. Like, look, we've both come up in TV. We've put in those hours. We've done those reps. We're sort of like just, you know, TV structure robots. So how do you start thinking about structure for features? Is it different? And what did you learn in the process of writing Atlas?
No, it's a great question, and it's different than it's not, you know. I think that, you know, whether you're adhering to a three act structure or you're really breaking it down, you know, every 15 pages, every 15 minutes, which is my preference, because it's closer to TV structure, just in terms of thinking of like, you know, this is an act of, it's not three acts. Sorry, let me do the math really quickly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's more of an eight act structure, right? Than considering it three, but it's the same movements no matter what happens, right? And so my attacking it is essentially the same that I do with television. I think the biggest thing is that you just need to, you know, kind of need to end the story. you actually get resolution instead of really making like, okay, well, what's the cliffhanger? You know, Because you get to use all your other, you know, tools in your writer's toolkit to make sure that your act break cliffhangers are keeping the propulsion going and keeping the momentum going. But otherwise, I think I might be in the minority. I think it's quite similar. And I think that everything that I've done in television really prepared me for that. There are, you know, I think there are really key differences though. And the key differences really come in some more of the minutia, which is, you know, scenes in features can be a whole lot longer. And the impetus of, oh, well, if a scene has to be 2 pages or less, that I feel like has been, you know, drilled into me in television, is so many of the notes that I got on, especially early features or even Atlas, was, this is too, like, it's too short, like, expand this. And I'm like, yeah, but it's already 2 pages. They're like, no, don't worry about that, because you want to spend time in these scenes. Some of these scenes need to be that long. And certainly that structure is changing in television as well, but it's like, it's very, very different in features of, it's not about scene to keep the momentum going. Sometimes you do need to stop down. Sometimes you do need to enjoy just luxuriating in the dialogue of a moment that you just don't have the space for in a lot of television.
Was it a challenge for you to sort of like find the room to play, to find that breathing room?
It goes back to kind of almost one of your original questions, which was, you know, how has my process changed? And that is certainly one of them, because Atlas is really, it's a two-hander between Jennifer Lopez and this, you know, mech suit AI that she is stuck inside. It has more in common with Training Day or Lethal Weapon, or here's some references that people won't get, Alien Nation or Enemy Mine, which are, you know, huge sci-fi touchstones for me. But it's a two. It's essentially a two-hander, and writing a two-hander, one of the most important things is the dialogue. It's all about this relationship between two people, and that dialogue, whether it's, you know, Denzel and Ethan Hawke in a car, you know, that has to be sparkly. That has to be, you know, you have to write the voice. It has to be sparkly. It has to keep momentum. It's not, you know, we're not writing a David Mamet play here where it's just like, okay, dialogue, dialogue, dialogue. It still has to accomplish so many things simultaneously. It has to move plot forward. It has to move character forward. And you're burying exposition so deep in there that you can't, you know, hopefully see it. It has to do a lot of things. And that was a huge challenge that I had never really undertaken before. And whereas in Spiderwick, it was about the removal of dialogue for me. In Atlas, it was about putting in, it was the exact opposite.
Something I read recently, specifically about, you know, character development in movies and television, is that in movies, there's no stutter step. It's a character is going from A to B. Whereas there's room for that nuance in television because, you know, you've got 8 hours or 10 hours.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that's definitely correct, because you don't have to, you know, you get to have the episode that has like nothing, you know, in Spiderwick, I have an episode that has essentially it's a two-hander between our villain and our hero, but it's a pure character piece. It's not really moving plot forward. It is just luxuriating in the characters. The hard thing about features is, yes, you do need to move from point A to point B with that, but these are still some of the most iconic characters that we still love and adore, right? Are from movies. And why do we love and adore them? Because their characters are developed and they are really fully fleshed out, and we invest in them and we see ourselves in them. And that doesn't happen because they're just moving from point A to point B. I think it is it what's incumbent upon us as writers and filmmakers is, yes, we have to move them from point A to point V with efficiency, but you still have to have the character moments. You still have to, even within those the confines of, you know, now it's less than 100 pages, sometimes it's less than 90 pages. You have to find the way to put it in so that they so that your characters don't feel shallow, and they don't it's obviously a difficult thing to do. Otherwise, every movie would be a huge hit, and we would be investing in all these characters. But you know, yes, you have less space to do it in, but it's still in, like, you still have to execute on it, and that's a combination of not only the writing, but it's also the director and it's also the actor. It's like, how can that come together to create something with a massive amount of depth?
So Atlas was a 5-year development process. Spiderwick was a 4-year development process. Now, granted, we had a full-on pandemic and a strike, several strikes in there, but tell me about, like, what was going on in those processes? Why did they take so long? Why does everything take so long now?
I wish I knew the answer to that. If I had the answer to that, I would hopefully try to speed things up. You know, I think things just take a long time now. I think, you know, and if I could nail it down to one reason, is because we all want assurance that it's going to be a hit. We all want that, you know, certainly the studios want that insurance that this is going to work. And the way to feel better about that is, let's do more, you know, on the TV side, let's get more scripts. Let's get a series Bible. Let's get a room together. You know, my hope is mini rooms do go away, because it's awful for all the reasons why we struck. But that's a reason, you know, it used to be you sold a pilot, you wrote the pilot, you shot the pilot, you went to series. And I was just actually talking about that. Like, I sold pilots as late as September, wrote the draft by December, got picked up in January to shoot, had delivered it by May. That's fast. That's months in comparison to years. And, you know, I think that with budgets increasing and the need for television to look as good as features, that with that level that things are being made at, you know, and almost rightfully so, you want to know it's going to be good, and it's going to do well. And the unfortunate thing is, no one knows how to do that. If we did, they would all be hits and they would all be fantastic, and everything would be, you know, a huge hit. But because we don't know how to do that, it takes a long time. And especially, look, a movie like Atlas is a huge, but like it's a tremendous budget, and you know, they want to know it's being spent wisely and on the right scenes in the right places. And that movie in specific was also, you know, we had different actresses attached at different points. Those actresses had their notes and they needed, which needed to be addressed. And then when they went away, someone else had their notes. And then, you know, once J-Lo came on board, it started to go quicker. But it's definitely, you know, that process of, okay, making sure she's happy with it, making sure Brad Payton, the director, is happy with it, making sure Netflix is happy with it. And then you have to make sure it's fitting the budget. And then, you know, and that just takes time. That takes time to get to the right place.
Absolutely. I mean, this all makes sense. And for all of these reasons,
we get a layer upon layer of second guessing and third guessing and fourth guessing. Makes sense.
Yeah, completely. And it's a, you know, it's a human look, it's a human reaction, and this, it's a lot of money, and you want to make sure that you're, that they are spending their money wisely. But, you know, I wish I could make them, you know, more assured in the product. You know, I wish I could, you know, whether it's waving a magic wand or being more convincing, in my pitches or in the screen, in the script, that, that would make them feel better.
Yeah. But this is the industry we work in. Were both of these projects, projects that you pitched on to get the jobs?
No. I mean, yes, in some ways, yes. I was working for Atlas. I was working with Brad and his producer and now my dear friend Jeff Fearson on Daybreak, and we were in the, you know, we were kind of at the end of finishing. We were about to finish shooting Daybreak, and Brad and Jeff were like, "Hey, you know, we want to take this, is a script that we're developing. Would love to take hear your take on it. Want to hear, have you read it?" And I read it, and I was like, "Hey, here are my thoughts." And I didn't. And I wasn't necessarily doing it to get the job. I was also, you know, one of the things I love is reading people's scripts and sharing thoughts and having a community of writers around me all the time, that we can bounce each other's ideas off of and that we can go to. So I'm like, I was certainly happy to do it, you know, no matter what, because I love Brad and I love Jeff. And then I, you know, like what I had to say, and then I pitched Netflix. They were like, "Great, go do your pass." So that's how I got on that. And the you know, what's always been amazing to me about Atlas, because I know how the feature game works, a lot of this writer comes in, another writer comes in, another writer comes in, you know, that they kept on coming back to me to write draft after draft after draft. You know, I have only the biggest admiration and respect for the Netflix executives, Ori Marmer and Andrew Norman, who are awesome, because, you know, we consistently saw the same movie, and hearing their notes and really getting deep into the trenches with them was a joy, because it was like, okay, yes, we can totally do this. And that they, you know, that they wanted to keep working with me, I felt so honored. Spiderwick was much more of a traditional, hey, here are the books. You need to pitch the writers. You need to pitch Paramount. There's other writers going for this. So you know, it's a bake-off. It's a competition. I hate that feeling. That sucks. But knew that that was the case. And honestly, right. At first,
it's at least, you know,
at least, you know, and that's like, it's better to know than like to be, feel like, oh, I wasn't, this was the competition time. At least they were up front, which was much better. And honestly, initially, when they said, "Do you want to do Spider-Man Chronicles?" I actually said no. Because yeah, I, you know, it's a joke, but I like to say my niche is families who move to Victorian houses and find that magic exists. It, you know, I've done it now a number of times, and I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna do this again. I didn't know I was that, like, that specifically pigeonholed. I know we all get pigeonholed, but like, that's really specific. And then Nicole Clemens at Paramount, who is again just like such an amazing collaborator, was like, please read it again. I think you'll find something different. And sure enough, I did. And it was because in the book itself is a real relevant, important story about mental health, and especially about teenage mental health. And this was right at the start of the pandemic, and I was witnessing this with my own kids, of anxiety and depression and the shame of feeling those things, and instead of talking about them. And so this was a real opportunity to tell a really wonderful story, a story that I loved, but also give it a layer of depth and meaning that is inherent in the DNA of the books, but now we aged up the character so we could actually talk about it more. And that was, you know, one of the main, I talked about two main things in my pitch. I talked about that, and I talked about, especially with Tony and Holly, I was like, look, I came up on all of this Brian Froud's Fairies and Jim Henson's Labyrinth and Dark Crystal. And that is my, that's my DNA. And in fact, I was in a different room, but I was like, oh wait, I have my D&D monster manual right here. And I was like, and I wanted to show it to them, because I was like, look, all these pages are dog marked because I was so infatuated. And they're like, oh, you speak our language. And that's also really important. Like that is almost one of the most important things, is in almost any collaboration, whether it's with authors that you're writing their books into a series, or even with executives, or even with your crew and cast, it's like you have to be speaking same cinematic language. And if you're not, that's when things really go to hell. That's when it's like, oh, we're making two different versions of this. This is where strife comes from, when you have two different ideas of what the show is. And it's so important to know we're all making the same show. We all have the same references. And when you make the reference, you generally know they're gonna grok it, and they're gonna understand what you're talking about. And that's what we had that from jump.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you had the two most important things for approaching, a way into a property, which is like, the shibboleth, right? Like you are passionate about the genre elements, but you also have something to say. That's what makes for a good show. It's why I'm excited to watch Spiderwick Chronicles. Aaron, thank you so much for chatting. We'll end as we always do by asking what you are watching on television these days. What's getting you excited or inspired?
I am watching X-Men 97, and it is so bonkers good. It was amazing. The first four episodes are awesome and nostalgic. And then you hit episode five and you're like, I am watching something completely different, and I can't wait to finish it. I almost am sad that there's only some episodes left, because I just wanted to keep going and going and going. It is really a profound animated series.
I mean, I keep hearing this, and put exactly that way too. Do I have to have watched the X-Men cartoon?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm very biased as somebody. I did watch the X-Men cartoon and have been collecting X-Men my whole entire life, so I'm biased. I don't really think it's...
I mean, no, I love X-Men. I love the comics. I just... That was 25 years ago. I don't remember that cartoon.
It was a long time ago. No, I don't think... I really don't think it's necessary. I think that the storytelling that they're doing is just has such a layer of depth I'm so in awe that it's TVY7. It doesn't feel like it to me. And that they are able to do that within that rating confine. It's kind of beautiful.
Oh, that's great. I can't wait to check it out. Thanks so much. Come back anytime.
Oh, dude, I absolutely will. Thank you for having me.